Yeah, Friday night. Welcome. Cairo's Nights. Spike O'Neill, Matt Butler. Woo! This is one of those albums that my uncle turned me on to. You know, I was, as a kid in Baltimore, I was, my older brother and I were the products of a divorced home. And it's therapy night, folks. Strap in. It's going to be here a while. We're the products of a divorced, divorced family.
This is a good deal. Usually I have to pay $150 per session. Now I actually get paid to attend this one.
So, my mom was a single woman with two young boys and had two brothers and a sister that were my aunts and uncles. You can leave that music up and play a little bit. That's nice to tell the story, a little background music. And just a little down, a little. Sorry, but I'm just messing with you.
Do I tell you how to do your job?
Yes, you do, and I appreciate it when you do. I appreciate it when you do. So my mom's got these two boys, and, you know, she's not only working full-time, she's trying to date and meet somebody new, you know. And my brother and I were often put into the care of my two uncles, one or the other, or my aunt. And we would always find ourselves on weekend nights in the summertime in the care of my youngest uncle. And we would be sick of watching two little monsters. We would just be forced to kind of tag along with him as he went about and tried to live his normal teenage life in the 60s as he could, having to babysit his single older sister's two sons. And I'll never forget, like, music like this being on the stereo in the car that we would drive around in. You know, and we'd be we'd be treated to the likes of Alice Cooper or Steely Dan or whatever rock music in the late 60s, early 70s. And I might get my years messed up. It was probably at that point, it was early 70s, wouldn't have been late 60s. But we got turned on to rock and roll, like, in the backseat of my uncle's friends' cars pretty early in life. I mean, luckily they weren't, you know, smoking cigarettes or drinking in the car that I can remember. I'm sure they probably were. And they were respectful of, you know, my uncle and the fact that he was in charge of us. We kind of got a little little advanced course in rock and roll as very young kids, my brother and I. We had pretty cultured tastes in elementary school. So it's nice that this music takes me back so far into my life. You know, into better, simpler times. I was going to talk a little bit about, we're playing just enough that song not to have to pay Steely Dan 37 cents in royalties. By the way, folks, if you wonder why Matt took that out so quick. And I appreciate your covering our asses there, buddy. I mean, give me one second, folks. Sorry, that was me clearing my throat and a moment of silence for the brain cells I lost in the back of the car in the 70s. Cheers. Remember hearing Black Sabbath's Paranoid for the first time as a pre-10-year-old, right? Crazy. Crazy stuff. Good stuff. The Beatles, the Stones, yada, yada. Going to talk a little bit about the story which came up today, and it's relevant because, and I remembered why I was talking about soccer earlier. I kind of lost my train of thought earlier. The World Cup begins this weekend, and the World Cup 2022/23 takes place in the I guess it's Middle Eastern nation of Qatar. You know, I'm not sure. I know where Qatar is. I'm not sure. Lisa's giving me the Cairo Newsroom thumbs up. Thank you, Lisa. I love that you're here. Qatar is hosting the World Cup. And oftentimes when a major sporting event is awarded to a country, there is some backlash that this country is not as modern thinking about with regard to civil rights or whatever issue it may be, gender rights, personal freedoms, as they should be in order to showcase a world event like the World Cup. I mean, Olympics are fun, but the World Cup's bigger. Maybe not in this country. Maybe in this country, soccer is a little sister to football or baseball or even basketball. But globally, we ain't got a clue in America to how popular soccer is, and the World Cup in particular. So when FIFA awarded the World Cup 2022/23 to Qatar, a lot of eyebrows were raised. A lot of voices were raised in protest because Qatar is one of those, I don't know if it's an Islamic nation by definition, but it's a, I think it's a mostly Muslim country. I think it's a safe assumption to
make.
And
to be clear, a very fundamentalist subset of the Islamic faith.
Okay. Is that what it is in Qatar? Pretty fundamentalist. Yeah. So, and therein lies the rub for the rest of the planet, which is hopefully evolving and progressing toward a more inclusive way to look at life and society. And please don't take this as an insult to those who believe otherwise. I know this is a fundamentalist belief based on their religious beliefs, and we all have the right to believe as we choose. But, you know, when your religious beliefs don't include everybody in your views, I don't know that I can back it. I mean, I know I can't. And I can't sit quietly and say nothing. I mean, for the most part, who am I? I'm one guy on a planet. One guy on a planet of 8 billion. Again, this week we had 8 billion. And Qatar had protests against them as a nation and their policies and beliefs. The LGBTQ community in Qatar especially, a law was passed that public displays of affection are frowned upon, if not outlawed, in Qatar. Homosexuality, outlawed in Qatar. And folks say, how can you cheer for the World Cup? How can you even award the World Cup to a company that will, or country, that will be so oppressive to many of their citizens? And you follow the money. Qatar is one of the richest nations in the world because of their oil holdings. And Qatar built these beautiful, beautiful stadiums. Because when you got all the money in the world, you spare no expense when you're showing off for the world. Now, a couple issues have arisen. One, not so recently, one immediately recently. I'll start with the immediate problem that came up. Qatar banned the sale of alcohol at the World Cup events. And that's a problem because Budweiser spent $75 million to become the sponsor of the 2022-23 World Cup. And when your number one sponsor is a beer company and you won't sell beer at the events, it raises a couple eyebrows, causes a little bit of a fluff there. Qatar has announced that they will sell, Budweiser's non-alcoholic product will be there for them. I don't know if it's Bush One or something. I'm not a fan of non-alcoholic beers, although I'm sure they serve a meaningful place and are tasty as hell in our beer drinking society. So Qatar's got a little bit of an issue that they're the number one sponsor of the World Cup. Budweiser can't be sold at the venues. I've raised a few eyebrows. In fact, it's almost insulting that that's what got the world's attention when Qatar was, oppressing its citizens, and that wasn't enough an issue to get media coverage.
Why are we not boycotting this?
Well, that's a fair question that many people are asking, Matt. It's a fair question.
I have my theories. Okay. Of course, they're all cynical.
Sure. Well, hey, you know what? Just because it's cynical doesn't mean it's not spot on.
I'm reaching a point in my life as I age where I am realizing things are all about money and all about selfishness and comfort. And people won't take stands on things that affect their comfort or their entertainment. So if you're entertained by this, then you're going to watch it and support it, whatever. You'll carry around devices in your hand that are manufactured with borderline slave labor. We just as a country are some of the most self-absorbed, selfish people, and we don't care about the tragedies happening internationally. I think that's shallow, and I think it's sad.
Matt, I got to tell you, man, I've been waiting for this day for so long. Welcome. Welcome, my friend. We've been waiting for you to get here. We're so proud of you today. No, dude, so many people in the world are just as ticked as you are at this. You're right. You're right about all that. It's a sad state of affairs. By the way, Bud Zero, thank you, Texter, is the non-alcoholic beverage sold at these stadiums. Well, Matt, if you thought you were cynical on your views of why are we taking part in a World Cup that is being hosted by a nation, a backwards nation like Qatar.
that does not share the values that most people in this country and most enlightened countries around the world do share, by the way, of tolerance and of freedom.
Well, you're going to really, really, really get on your high horse when I play this next clip for you. I'm taking a couple seconds to bring it up here. We featured this afternoon, and I could tell you the story, but it was so very, very, very well handled earlier this afternoon. So I'll bring up my board here, and I think I have this. Okay, so this is a story of what happened during the construction of the many beautiful palatial stadiums that will host the various World Cup comes, and they play multiple games in multiple cities or multiple stadiums. And that way the country gets to all enjoy the world-class soccer of World Cup competition throughout the country. And again, Qatar is one of the most richest countries in the world. So this report from CBS News' Holly Williams.
They went wild in Qatar 12 years ago when they heard their country had won the right to host the World Cup. A sheikh from the country's ruling family promised it would be a success.
Thank you for giving Qatar a chance. And we will not let you down. You will be proud of us.
A Middle Eastern nation roughly the size of Connecticut, Qatar's one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It's poured more than $200 billion into 8 state-of-the-art, air-conditioned soccer stadiums and all the other infrastructure to host over a million spectators. But to build it, Qatar's relied on an army of migrant workers, mostly from South Asia and Africa, toiling in temperatures of up to 120 degrees and living in crowded, squalid camps.
They're like anyone else in the world. You want to have a better life than your parents. You want your children to go to college, to have a better life than you. So you're desperate for any opportunity. So you have a World Cup dependent on migrant workers because they're cheap. And migrant workers are cheap because they're being exploited.
Mustafa Kadri founded Equidem, an organization that investigates labor abuses. He says he was arrested in Qatar while researching conditions there, including forced labor, workers going unpaid for months at a time, and unsafe work sites with deadly results.
It's very hard to give an exact figure. I would suspect it's actually in the hundreds. I think hundreds of workers have died to make this World Cup possible.
Budhan Pandit left his home in Nepal to build roads in Qatar, sending money back to his family before he was killed in an accident last year. His widow, Ermila, told us her family received no compensation, just her husband's body. They've now fallen deeper into poverty, she says, and sometimes can't afford food. Labor rights groups want Qatar to set up a fund of around $500 million to compensate injured and unpaid workers and the families of those killed. This month, Qatar rejected that suggestion as a publicity stunt.
It's really conflicting, and that, I think, is also makes you very upset, knowing that we're going to watch our teams that we love play, and at the same time, this is all made possible because of this incredible exploitation.
Yeah. So, how does the world watch the World Cup from Qatar, knowing all these elements are in play? I mean, the money of Budweiser sponsorship, okay, that's just an embarrassing little thing, and people can't get a beer at the stadium. By the way, you can get a beer at one of the VIP parties or VIP suites at these, you know, 8 stadiums, and they said it was $500 billion. That's like $60 billion a state. Did I hear that right in that report? A stadium? You imagine how palatial. These are air-conditioned stadiums in a place that gets to be 120 degrees.
Meanwhile, people go unhoused and starve around the world, but hey, billions for stadiums.
Right.
Go us.
Right. Well,
it's, I mean as a human race,
I don't mean
as a country.
No, I hear you, buddy. I hear you. And believe me, the USA is the least, not the least, but one of the lesser supporters of World Cup soccer. There'll be folks coming in from Europe, obviously, right? From Europe, from Asia, from Africa. World Cup soccer is just that, World Cup. We call it the World Series, but it's a joke. It's all just America. World Cup soccer really is the world.
Why do we allow American companies to do business with these people?
Because money rules, and we we have business interests that many of us benefit from. Companies that do business in Qatar or do business with these people have funds that help populate pension funds. There is always a rationalization for doing the wrong thing. You can always find a reason that it's okay to exploit the lesser amongst us so that the richer amongst us can get even richer, because there's a little crumb in it for us. So it's a good idea. If we stop that, you know, Mrs. Johnson's pension fund would suffer. So you got to let Qatar, you know, build these if $50, $80 billion stadiums until people die. Otherwise, Mrs. Johnson's pension fund might take a hit. There's always a way to rationalize it, but and I understand that it's a cynical, you cannot not be cynical.
And is this not a good opportunity too to point out that maybe more Americans should learn something and watch some news from outside the United States and learn some of what's going on in these other countries and how people are still being persecuted for who they are?
Absolutely.
Instead of dismissing people who view human rights as a modern issue?
Or being woke. I love when I get called woke because I care about people in Qatar who were living in a container, shipping container in 120 plus degree heat, working until they die building these stadiums so the swellest of the planet can enjoy World Cup soccer in complete air conditioned comfort in 120 some degree Qatar. I hear you, man. What I hope from all this is that as the World Cup begins this weekend, the United States will play Wales. I think it's on Monday, our first round game.
And hey, shout out to all the obscenely wealthy going there just to do it for the gram. You know, you're heroes, people. Come on, buddy.
What I hope is that these stories of what people have to go through in these countries, that this world stage will also become a world platform for people making us all aware of some of the people in this world, the conditions they have to live in.
You're a more hopeful man than I.
I am. That's why we're such a good team. You be Captain Cynic, I'll be Captain Sundrops, and we'll move through, man. It'd be great. Anyway, it's a story I thought was worthy of our time on Cairo Nights, worthy of your time as an audience. For you folks still stuck in the traffic jack down there in the South End, I feel for you, man. I'm glad you're with us. I hate that you're such a captive audience, but I'm glad you're here with us. A lot of people in the text telling us they said 200 billion through 8 cities. Thank you. See, this guy got some sleep last night. This guy didn't work a 12-hour day. Maybe he did, I don't know. But still, at 8 stadiums through 200 billion, that's $25 billion a stadium. My math's not that bad, even though I'm tired. No stadium in America's football world was 25 billion. Not even Jerry World down in Dallas was 25 billion. Anyway, folks, let's be considered amongst of those least fortunate amongst us. That would make Matt happy, and that's why I'm here. Make Matt happy. This is Friday night. Cairo Nights. We'll be right back. Story really brought him out of the woodwork on the text line. This Matt, nice job. This was at the suggestion of a texter, I think Stephanie, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Don't you forget about me. About the workers, and they estimate 2,400 workers died building these 8 stadiums totaling $200 billion over in Qatar for the World Cup, which is taking place starting on Monday and running through, I think, next spring of 2023. One text point out, say, hey, man, the outrage about the beer and the workers is faux outrage because this deal was cut years ago. I see your point, but just because Qatar was awarded these World Cup games 12 years ago doesn't mean that the outrage over horrific conditions to an exploited workforce.
Spike, I have a serious question for you.
Sure, sure.
What percentage of the people, let's just say in America, what percentage of the people in America that claim avidly and avowedly to be pro-life give one single thought to the lives of those people?
Bud, I don't know, man. You made a great point about us all would benefit all of us to get a view outside of our own world. You know, and a texter asked what kind of international news sources would we recommend to get a view of the world from outside of the lens that American media shows it to us through.
The BBC is really great. Yeah. So is the CBC for Canadian news.
And believe it or not, so is Al Jazeera. If you can get past any overarching Islamophobia you may feel, and I'm not saying you do, but when you hear the term for Al Jazeera, you think of how it's used often as a propaganda piece for radical extremists. That's not who they are. They are one of the world's largest news organizations, and they can often cover our news with a more unbiased view than we often can ourselves. So CBC, BBC, Al Jazeera. Who else did you mention? One more, I thought.
The Guardian is good, although admittedly, editorially, they do lean left. But they do have a lot of interesting reporting depth on certain stories that's worth taking a look at, because they have a large amount of international reporters that are actually going to these countries.
Right. Oh, anyway.
I do not, however, recommend RT.
And this is where I could make a joke about any of a handful of conservative Republican House representative members who have quoted RT directly on shows like Tucker Carlson. But hey, we're having fun.
And you're above that, Spike.
I am above that. We're having fun tonight.
That sort of nasty sarcasm is best left to me.
Best left unsaid. We're just asking questions, you know? We're not saying anything. We're just asking questions. Here's a story that Ursula brought up this afternoon. Ursula, oh my gosh, am I tired? I'm so sorry.
Sherry Elicker.
Sherry Elicker, thank you. Ursula was here today too, I promise. She sat in this chair. Maybe I'm channeling her spirit, her well-dressed, educated spirit. So imagine you're invited over to a friend's house. Hey, come over. We're going to order out, you know, just casual. Okay, should I bring anything? Yeah, bring a couple bottles of wine. Bring some dessert, whatever. Okay. And you show up and they order takeout. And these days, takeout can be as expensive as eating at home. Or, you know, cooking at home and having it if you're cooking for friends. And at the end of the night, the host, the people who invited you over, hand you a bill or ask you to pay for your share of the takeout. This was a letter actually posed to one of those advice writers. You remember the Dear Abbeys of the world? And her sister, too. What was her? Her sister had a column, too. I can't remember what her name is, but I know Lisa's out there jumping up and down like she's on Jeopardy. It's awesome. So how do you respond to that? If someone says, "Hey, you know, we're all gonna chip in for the meal. Your portion was $45." I'm like, wow. I'm a little put off by that. The advice column writer says, you know, she should have said, you know, I declined to take part in that. Had I known you would have, we were going to be asking us to help pay for the meal, we would have declined the invitation. How do you say that to somebody you're friends with? You're sitting in their dining room. You know, the writer of the letter to this advice column said, "I was caught off guard. I didn't know what to say. To me, it's not the money as much as I just don't feel you don't treat friends like this. In the past, we bought takeout at the same restaurant and took it to their house. We never mentioned that we wanted to pay for it or we wanted them to pay for it, vice versa. You know, especially when she asked me, what should I bring? It kind of gave the inclination that they were going to provide dinner and we could provide dessert and wine. I bet it probably worked out pretty even. You buy a couple of bottles of wine that aren't like screw caps and a nice little dessert, you probably spend as much as the dinner itself. At that point, you say, okay, well, you know, we spent this on dessert. Let's square up and be even. And if we're going to go Dutch in the future, let's let each other know ahead of time. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't think it's wrong to split a bill. Don't get me wrong. I think it's wrong to spring it on people at the end of a night. The writer of the advice column was like, no way, shape, or form. It's unacceptable to solicit money for your event. And if you're hosting something, if you're hosting a dinner party, you're hosting, you're providing, right? You don't have to, you know, it's inappropriate to ask somebody to help pay for that. That just seems kind of just, ugh. If we all stuck to the, and this is part of the story here, and the story's in the Washington Post. If we all stuck to the you invite, you pay rule, we'd never have any celebrations that didn't involve the host cooking, cleaning, and otherwise handling all the preparations. One reader wrote during one of the online chats, well, that's kind of what hosting is. You know, if you have a big, I mean, say, for example, Thanksgiving's coming next week. I know many families that say, you know, hey, here's a list of everything that we're going to need for dinner. You know, especially these days of social media. You can create a Facebook page just for, you know, Spike's Thanksgiving dinner. Who wants to bring what? Here's a list of what we're going to have, what we'd like to have, or if there's something you like to make and you'd like to bring. And you got to coordinate so that eight people don't bring bean salad or whatever. You know, nobody thought to bring whatever, you know, nobody thought to bring yams. How'd you like to be invited to Thanksgiving dinner? And at the end of which, you know, everyone's thankful and the food was delicious and the leftovers are there and the cleanup's all done. And, you know, everybody gets handed a check like at a restaurant. A lot of stories this week about how much it's much more expensive to cook at home than it is to go out and eat on Thanksgiving, given the cost of groceries these days. Can you even imagine getting a bill from a friend or family at the end of Thanksgiving dinner? I don't know what I'd do. My head would explode. I wouldn't explode, but be a little miffed. Don't know that I could be ever think of them the same again. And it's different if you do it ahead of time. If you say, hey, it's expensive this year. And you know, in fact, if you've been invited somewhere for Thanksgiving dinner, might not be a bad idea to reach out to the host ahead of time. Hey, look, I know how things are these days. I know everybody's kind of tightening their belt a little bit. It can't be cheap to host 12, 14, 10, 6 of us, whatever number it is. You know, can I help? You know, we got everything we need. Well, can I slip you a few bucks to help cover the cost? We appreciate you doing all the work. The hosting, the cleaning, the cooking, the serving, all that stuff. At least let us help pick up some of the check, some of the cost of putting the meal together. They say turkeys are so expensive this year, Matt, for a couple of different reasons. There was a huge avian flu that wiped out a huge portion of the turkey population. Okay? And I know Joe Biden likes to sniff young people, but I don't think you can blame him for an avian flu. So I don't think it's Joe Biden's fault the turkeys are more expensive than before. I'm sure Tucker Carlson will blame it on Joe Biden. Another part of the reason turkeys are so expensive this year, in 2018, the price of turkey went through the floor. Incredibly low prices for turkey. So turkey farmers bred less turkeys. The ones that are coming due this year, the ones that are being served on our tables this year. So they were tired of not getting market value for all the birds they invested money in raising, hatching and raising. So they intentionally shorted the turkey supply for this year. And then that gets hit with an avian flu. Again, not Joe Biden's fault. And what you find is record turkey prices. But by God, you know, inflation. It's all the guy in the Oval Office. It's all his fault. Anyway, I hope you have a wonderful and joyous Thanksgiving. If you've been invited out, call ahead. See what you can bring. See if you can help pay. And if they hand you a bill, please call me next week after the Thanksgiving. Let me know. I'd love to know if anybody actually handed out checks at the end of a Thanksgiving dinner. It's Cairo Nights. I'm Spike O'Neill with Matt Butler, and we'll be right back.
At it this way. Think of how stupid the average person is, and then realize half of them are stupider than that.
Fiction? Nice.
Actually, that's the lineup scene from Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, that's what I meant. That's what I meant. I was thinking when they're walking out of the diner, right? They've paid the check.
Yep.
Steve Buscemi, Mr. Pink, wouldn't tip because he doesn't believe in tipping.
Mm-hmm.
God, what a great scene.
Oh, I love that movie.
Oh, and that's one of those one camera not continuous scenes. You know, just fantastic. That's I was seeing Reservoir Dogs. And I'll shut up because this is the good part. always heard the urban legend that the entire budget for music for Reservoir Dogs was spent on Steeler's wheel stuck in the middle with you for that one scene with Michael Madsen.
Huh.
Where the cop that he had kidnapped.
Torture you.
Yeah, he
tortured. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. They spent their entire music, allotted music budget for the whole film on that, on getting Steeler's wheel stuck in the middle with you. So that there was pretty much a bargain cut for Quentin Tarantino. God, I love Quentin Tarantino movies. Just love them. You know, there are directors who have just such an incredibly unique style that you can't help but know it's exactly who that is them. Only they could make that kind of movie.
It's a rare talent that has such singular visions. I would say David Lynch is another director like that.
Absolutely.
Has, his movies are unmistakably his. They're not interchangeable.
Was it Frank Capra? Right? It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Same type of thing. But then you get into the guys like Martin Scorsese, who's done so much amazing work, but they've all kind of got that.
Do you remember a Scorsese film called After Hours?
Well, tell me a little more, maybe.
It was, I think, 1984. It was this kind of a surrealist comedy about this guy. He's out late at night, I think, in New York City, and all these bizarre things happen to him.
85 film. Griffin Dunn, yes. I looked it up. I didn't remember it. But yeah. Yes, I do remember this. I do remember this. I didn't realize it was a Martin Scorsese film.
Yeah. It's surreal. Wow. I've had dreams like that movie, which is really trippy.
Griffin Dunn, by the way, who starred in that movie, was also from American Werewolf in London. Went on to become a director himself, if I'm not mistaken. Another one is Guy Ritchie. You can't watch a Guy Ritchie movie and not know it's a Guy Ritchie movie. Was it Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels? Of course, Snatch, and then The Gentleman. Those are his only three. Those are the only three I'm familiar with, but they all have such an unmistakable style to them that they could be nobody else but Guy Ritchie movies. You've seen The Gentleman, right? It's Matthew McConaughey's a starring role in that movie, and the usual cast of characters you would expect to see in a Guy Ritchie movie. You mentioned Bricktop about pig farmers from the movie Snatch. Anybody out there who hasn't seen the movie Snatch, it's about the underworld, illegal, bare-knuckle boxing, and like the organized crime syndicate in London. I say crime syndicate like I know the hell I'm talking about. It's about bookies and... It's a jewel. There's a heist movie. It's got some of the most amazing characters. Guys you would recognize from a lot of different places in your television or cinematic lexicon who are all in this Guy Ritchie movie. Is it Jason Statham, right? It's got a big major lead role in that. Brad Pitt has one of the most creative and clever roles he's ever been in Snatch. And everybody in it, from top to bottom, you recognize them from somewhere. But they're all brilliant, absolutely brilliant in Snatch. And you can watch it with the subtitles on, because when Brad Pitt's character, an Irish gypsy bare-knuckle boxer, speaks in the movie, it's impossible to understand a word he says. His accent is so thick and so good, you can't understand him. And you can watch with the subtitles to read what he's saying. But it's more fun if you don't and just try to figure it out, at least for the first couple of times you watch the movie. Then go back and watch the subtitles if you so choose and figure out exactly what the piker is saying in this movie. Brilliant. Well, his last name's O'Neill, too, which gives me a lot of pride in that one, you know? Mickey O'Neill. You like Dags? I love it. Oh, I love Dags. Not the burgers. Oh, it's Cairo Nights. I'm Spike O'Neill with Matt Butler. Now your music. Music changes everything, buddy. You're like a maestro. You're like a surgeon. You're like a psychiatrist.
This is the great Chicano band El Chicano. They're really good.
They're Russian folk, right?
Yeah. More like Latin soul.
There you go.
Good stuff.
It's Cairo Nights. I'm Spike O'Neill along with Matt Butler, and we'll be right back.